Thank you. I teach mathematics here at Trinity Western University, and it's my pleasure to share with you some reflections on one of my favorite equations. Now, I'm an applied mathematician, and I use the Navier-Stokes equations, or approximations to the Navier-Stokes equations, to run geophysical fluid simulations, including ice sheet flow and ocean dynamics. So, without further ado, let me introduce to you the Navier-Stokes equations. Now, before I lose half my audience, this is an accessible talk. But I can hardly give a talk on an equation without showing you this equation. So there is one equation, and it is the all-important equation. And here it is. There we go. So this is a non-linear differential equation. And sometimes I might say equation, sometimes I might say equation. So this is one equation here. Using some vector calculus, it's kind of several equations that have been wrapped up in and nicely packaged here. So for example, this U here, which denotes the velocity. You could have a velocity in your x, y, and z direction. So in that case, you could unpack this into three different equations. And then if you added boundary conditions and initial conditions and incompressibility, then you have kind of a whole collection of equations. Now, it may seem daunting, but this is basically Newton's second law of motion in disguise. So it's just what we learned in school: force equals mass times acceleration applied to fluid. So on the right hand side here, we have the forces. So this first one here, we have external body forces. So this is force because of gravity. We have internal forces to do with pressure gradients in the fluid parcel. And then we have internal stress forces to do with the viscosity, kind of the internal resistance of the fluid. And on this other side here, this actually denotes density, but of course density is mass per unit volume. So, and then we have the acceleration. And this is what we call a material derivative, because we're thinking of a parcel of fluid. And so you have a rate of change of velocity here at one point, but the fluid around it is also moving, so you have this spatial or geometrical rate of change here. So that's why there's two terms there. That's the gist of what we need to know. So this is a remarkable equation. Let me show you. So this equation describes fluid flow on a vast on the full range of length scale. So talking about the tiny droplet here, up to you could think of large Rossby waves in our atmosphere, or even going intergalactic. We have you could use these types of equations to describe galaxy formation, where we think of stars as being kind of particles in some kind of gas. So mathematicians, when we talk about fluids, we're talking not just liquids, but also gases. So again, Navier-Stokes describing the smoke plume here, your slow, viscous drip of syrup on your pancakes again. It's a fluid flow, and Navier-Stokes applies. And not just on length scales, all types of flow regimes. So here we see going from the nice lamina, this smooth flow here, nicely described by Navier-Stokes, and then it goes down the bump here, and we get some turbulence, you get churning, mixing, you get flow separation, you get these eddies being formed, and again, both that and that transition is all captured by this one equation. Really extraordinary. Because of this, these equations are so useful. So these equations are the foundation for producing numerical weather predictions. So here we've got a storm system here, and not just weather prediction, making climate projections. So, you know, the climate is the atmosphere, the oceans, the ice sheets. These are all fluids. These are all modeled by Navier-Stokes equations. It's hard to imagine having kind of safe, reliable air travel today without running simulations of the Navier-Stokes equations. And many more things besides. So, you know, you could think here about the bike design, the position of the rider. So we run these. So instead of having kind of these wind tunnels where you construct a bike or you can you find out what's the best position, you can run these simulations on a computer now. You don't have to redesign the bike, you just tweak your code and you can run it again. So we run these fluid simulations over and over again to try and gain efficiencies. You know, not just bikes, but racing cars, trucks, aeroplanes we've talked about, you know, efficient hulls for shipping. We could even talk about the guy's costume here. I remember there was...
Is that you?
No. I remember there was an Olympic Games where they were wearing these sharks in skin suits, and they were breaking all the world records because they designed these suits to be efficient. You can other areas fluid simulate looking simulations in computer games, making the fluids look realistic. Even in medical applications, you know, the heart pumps blood around the body. The blood is a fluid, so you can use Navier-Stokes simulations there, and maybe you want to design a better stent, or maybe you want to do a surgery and you want to know what's the best way of doing that. So again, you could run fluid simulations. So that brings me to this topic of effectiveness. So why are the Navier-Stokes equations so effective at describing our world? How can this one equation so accurately describe such a vast array of behaviours? It truly is a marvel to behold. And this, you know, this is just one example. So this thing happens all the time in mathematics, and there's a famous article by Wigner called "The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences." And he says, a couple of quotes here from the article, he says, the miracle, he calls it a miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift that we neither understand nor deserve. We should be grateful for it. You know, I might say it's a gift, the Navier-Stokes equation is a gift from God, and we should give thanks to, be grateful to God for it. So the enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious. So if you read this article again and again, it uses this word miracle, or this word mystery. So I hope maybe I've convinced you that the Navier-Stokes equation, you know, is surely one of the great triumphs of humankind. It's an extraordinary achievement what we can do with this one equation. It's the key to understanding fluid flows. If you like, it's kind of the access door to comprehending nature. But not just comprehending it, it's also an instrument for working with nature. If we think historically about the development, so Newton, Leibniz developed the calculus, then Swiss mathematician Daniel Bernoulli tried to apply the calculus to fluid flows, and spent his whole life working on this. And then Euler, perhaps the greatest mathematician of all time, took this on, and he added the body force terms. And then it was the French engineer Navier who came up with the form of the equation that includes the viscosity term. And then finally, Stokes, who's an Irish mathematician, but held the famous Lucasian Chair of Mathematics at Cambridge University, who really formalised it. She found some mistakes in Navier's derivations to come up with it. But all these great minds, and you know, and all users of the Navier-Stokes equations supposed the reliable and intelligent structure of fluids. And so these equations are a product of human minds, but they coincide with nature's true reality, and that is what is so remarkable. Pope Benedict said this. He said, the subjective reason and the objectified reason in nature are identical. So the subjective reason or the equation from the human mind maps onto the true objective reality of fluids in nature. And for him, he says, in the end, it is one reason that links them both and invites us to a unique creative intelligence. So unlike Wigner, who says it's a mystery, it's a miracle, I think we can posit here that there is one reason, and it is the ultimate reason, the underlying God of our creation. Now, I don't want to say it's all nice and cozy and all very well. Let me just stress that that written form of the equation may look simplistic, but actually solving those equations is actually extremely hard and very challenging. And it takes it took a lot of concerted effort from humans, a lot of collaboration. It took investments in computers. You know, from predicting the weather or predicting future climate change requires huge supercomputers. You know, the most powerful computers, which cost millions of dollars, and it takes teams of scientists over working decades to bring. Fruitfulness on that. And I think, you know, we've seen tremendous success from those efforts. And I think there's some nice ideas about how we're made in the image of God, that we want to comprehend our world, that we want to bring goodness, you know, we want to increase fruitfulness and flourishing, that we want to work, we can work in community and collaboration to strive to overcome these challenges. But it's even more challenging than that. So practically, we've kind of solved the equations and we can make good usefulness. But there's a huge mathematical question still about these equations. And that is there a mathematical guarantee that solutions of the Navier-Stokes equations would always exist? So we don't even, this is an unanswered question, we don't even know whether solutions of this equation will remain bounded and physically realistic for all time. And if you crack that one, there's a $1 million prize for it. So 18 years ago, the Clay Mathematics Institute came up with these, the seven most challenging, the most difficult, the most kind of important problems in all of mathematics. And this is one of them, and it still remains to be solved. This brings us to accessibility. How is it that human intellects can comprehend and utilize this mathematics? So this is another remarkable aspect. And it seems to me that it's almost like there's a Goldilocks zone for mathematics, that the mathematics that describes our world and has been such a powerful tool, mathematics of fluids, not so easy that we don't really care about it. It's not so difficult that it would be impossible for us to comprehend, but it seems to be just right where we can comprehend it, and we have to work hard. We have to work hard at it, and we can make gains. And you know, there's still unanswered questions, but they're seemingly within grasp. And again, I think that is remarkable. My final topic is mathematical beauty. So here we have, this is an aircraft here, and this is computational fluid dynamics. So this is a Navier-Stokes simulation of the airflow, and you can see the turbulence coming out the back of the wings there, the wings of the aircraft there. And in the there's a gallery in the science, there's a mathematics gallery called the Winton Gallery in the Science Museum in London, and the architects designed the building, the structure of the building, based on those flow lines there. And the architect said, we wanted to make tangible the beauty, sophistication, and empowerment of mathematics. And actually, in that case, the Navier-Stokes equations. So for an applied mathematician, the Navier-Stokes equations are just the best. We've got beautiful mathematics. You've got this elegant statement here with some beautiful mathematics behind it. And that beautiful mathematics is describing our beautiful world. This is our blue marble. Our planet is, we live on a fluid planet. And that's just beautiful. In 2014, they did a study where they put some mathematicians in an MRI scanner, and they gave them some equations to look at. And when a mathematician saw a beautiful equation, you know, the imaging, the scanner lit up, and they found that the experience of mathematical beauty correlates with activities in the same part of the emotional brain as the experience of beauty derived from other sources. It's a famous quote from Bertrand Russell. He said, mathematics, rightly viewed, possesses not only truth, but supreme beauty. And mathematicians are drawn to mathematics that is full of beauty, elegance, and surprise. But again, where does that sense of beauty come from? Surely it ultimately has to be grounded in God. So maybe I'll pose this question. If there's spiritual value in contemplating mathematical beauty, and does it point towards beauty in God? Here's a quote from David Bentley Hart, who's a theologian, historian, all-round genius. He says, any movement of the mind or will towards truth, goodness, beauty, or any other transcendental end is an adherence of the soul to God. It is the finite participation in the highest truth of existence. And, you know, he wasn't talking about mathematics here, but I think we can apply this statement to mathematics. If you like, mathematics is the finite participation in the infinite. And calculus, if you like, tames the infinite. We use the infinitesimally the school, and we can use this calculus to uncover truths about nature, and we can use these equations as tools to bring goodness and flourishing, and the equations are beautiful, and so I think this statement surely applies. And I'll finish with this Bible verse here as well, from Philippians. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. And so we should be thinking about the Navier-Stokes equation.
We have 5 minutes for some questions.
Sure, I think your hand was up first.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, so one comment is, I don't know if you know this, but the Einstein equations of general relativity under certain circumstances can be rewritten in Navier-Stokes form.
Okay.
If you might want to add that to your presentation. there's a connection with general relativity. But what I wondered, I mean, what I find fascinating about this and other things is that there's a sense in which nature, and I would venture to say God, is smarter than we are, right? In the sense that it's very difficult to solve these equations. You're right, we can do it. The turbulent flow was there of a plane going through the air or something.
Yeah, that's the most challenging part.
But nature knows how to do this. It knows, in other words, maybe the simplest computer to solve the problem is the system itself, right? And I'm wondering what you think of that. This seems to happen in we want to simplify in science, but for something like this, perhaps the least complicated way of figuring out what happens is to actually just put an airplane in a wind tunnel. And
yeah, but like as I was saying, I think, you know, wind tunnels have now been replaced by computational.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Because it's much, you know, you can't, to test a plane in a wind tunnel, you have to build a giant wind tunnel.
I know.
And then you have to change the plane and test it all again. So it's much easier to do it all on the computer. So that's a fantastic.
I guess, do you think nature's smarter than we are, or God is smarter than we are as men or not?
Well, I certainly think God is smart. there's no doubt.
What if I change the question to nature? When I say nature is smarter than we are, then ultimately nature might be the most efficient computer of certain problems. What would you say to that? Yes? No? Maybe?
Maybe. I don't think about
it. I think there was...
Sorry. Why don't you field questions?
I'd just like to follow on from that. I mean, yes, everything you say is true. But there's one thing we play around with, and that's the one unique system we've got. We've only got one Earth, we've only got one universe, and we can't run that as an experiment. And so the matter of modeling is a matter of survival.
Yes, so so the climate change is one aspect of that, where we can run fluid simulations into the future, and it has vital importance for perhaps our planetary survival here.
I'm returning to a question you asked in that very speech. Yes, there is spiritual value. There is nothing more satisfying than using mathematics to reach me.
I can't help but you read all of your slides about the image of God. I think you just skimmed over it. So what were you supposed to say with that? Not mine.
I think there's some more thought that I need to do there, but I think our willingness and a desire to comprehend our world and our place in our world is part of the image of God in us, and part of our striving, part of our working in community and collaboration. Maybe it even reflects the relational aspect of the image of God in us. So I think I didn't fully flesh that out, and that would be another talk, but I think there's certainly some things that could be pursued there.
One more question, Pat?
Yeah, you mentioned several times the mathematical beauty, but before that, we needed to, what is beauty? What is the criteria of beauty? Just a simple example, or is that your definition of mathematical beauty?
Well, I think that's... that's a tough one. I think that's where, again, that's kind of beyond the rational, if you like. That's being, you know, I don't think there's a mathematical description of beauty as such. I think that is something that is a transcendental experience. It goes beyond the rational, if you like.
Well, let's thank our speaker again.